the 23rd chapter of Ezekiel. For the benefit of you, those of you who are with us for the first time, we try to have in our study, I'm doing a preaching from the New Testament, but we try to have at least one study out of our various studies from the Old Testament. So we're going through the book of Ezekiel. And this 23rd chapter, I think, is one of the ugliest, if I can use the word ugly in the right sense. I think it's probably the ugliest chapter in all the Bible, it in chapter 16. Now, the two chapters, 16, which we had a month or two ago, deals with the nation as two women there, but idolatry is the thing that's dealt with in that chapter. The nation was destroyed because of idolatry. Now, in the 23rd chapter, it's idolatry plus their relationship with heathen nations, that is, their political aspect. So there were two things that contributed to the destruction of the nation. Primarily, idolatry. The other was an alliance with foreign nations. Now, in this lesson today, he is likening Israel and Judah to two harlots, two sisters, who became the wives of Jehovah. I will explain that a little bit later. And they both became harlots, and so were destined for destruction. And some of the language he uses in here, we say, well, that's not becoming the Bible. Yes, God always describes a thing as ugly in terms that you can see the ugliness of it. He describes a thing that's beautiful in terms that you can grasp the beauty of it. And so you have both the ugliness of sin and the beauty of righteousness. The ugliness of the wicked nations, and the beauty of the true Israel of God. And this is what we're trying to point out in this study from the Old Testament, especially Ezekiel, is the ugliness of the sins of the people and the effort that he was trying to make to bring them back to God. So as we study this chapter, keep that in mind, that it is not a beautiful chapter at all, but Ezekiel is a master at describing a thing in such a way that you don't fail to get the point. And that's certainly a commendable thing of anybody. I want to turn to the chapter now, and those of you who have been coming have something of the background of it. Now, the word of Jehovah came again unto me, saying, Son of man, there were two women, the daughters of one mother. That is, there was one nation. And you remember when it was divided, this is an allegory. Now, I got to thinking a while ago, it's an interesting thing that my three lessons today from three different books all deal with an allegory. The 23rd chapter of Ezekiel is an allegory of two women. In Romans 11 chapter, I'll study today, we have the allegory of the olive tree and the branches that were cut off and the branches that were planted. That was an allegory. Then tonight, in the Gospel of John, the 10th chapter, we have the allegory of the door and the shepherd. So that's just purely coincidental. I didn't plan it that way at all. It just turned out that way. We're dealing today in all three lessons with an allegory. Now, the word allegory comes from a compound Greek word that means to speak and to compare it with something. So it's a comparison. You take one thing and you compare something else with that one thing and get your lesson from it. So in this study this morning, the allegory of two women who were of one mother, that was one nation, they were divided. You remember they were divided at the death of Solomon between the northern tribes of Israel that were ruled over primarily by Ephraim or the people of Ephraim, and then you have Judah. Now Ephraim was much larger, Israel was much larger, and really was more prosperous than was Judah after the death of Solomon. So the northern part was more prosperous at that time. So now let's notice those. Here are your two women then, the two daughters of one mother. That was the original nation. And they played the harlot in Egypt. They played the harlot in their youth. There were their breasts pressed, and there was handled the bosom of their virginity. And the names of them were Oholah, the elder, and Oholibah, her sister. And they became nine, and they bare sons and daughters. And as for their names, Samaria is Oholah, and Jerusalem is Oholibah. Now that's Oholah, it means her tent. Her tent. Oholibah means my tent is her, or my tent in her. Now, I have no idea why that he used or selected these two words. He could go ahead and talk about Samaria and Judah, but these had some significance to them, maybe that we don't see clearly today. But that is her tent and my tent in her, that is God's tent or tabernacle or place of worship, was in Jerusalem, whereas Israel has set up her own worship there, and it was her tent. That is her worship. Now, you remember that at the death of Solomon, when the kingdom was divided, and Jeroboam the first set up an altar at Bethel and another at Dan, and appointed his own priesthood, and along with that priesthood, his own days of worship, and his own type of worship there. So it was actually a Jehovah worship. They worshiped Jehovah after the calf there. So it was a perverted Jehovah worship, very perverted. And then later on, they introduced Baal worship as the national religion under Ahab and Jezebel. But now he's going to use these two. Now we ask the question, well, how can God have two wives, and yet if he doesn't condemn, against polygamy there? Well, this is an allegory. That doesn't mean that God had two wives. It simply means in this allegory, these two women, who are actually God's people supposed to have been, how that they left God and were unfaithful to him and committed lewdness and whoredom, until after a while he had to cast them out. Oh, so remember, we're dealing with an allegory that teaches a lesson. And what is the lesson? The lesson is the unfaithfulness of Israel and Judah, who were God's people, and they were totally unfaithful unto him. Now this is the point we want to keep in mind. And when you study an allegory or proverb, don't try to make it crawl on its all fours. That's a statement that a gospel preacher made to me over 60 years ago. He said, Homer, when you're preaching and on that door, he said, don't try to make a proverb an allegory crawl on its all fours. Now, what do you mean by that? You mean by that, don't try to make every little thing in it apply to something. I remember hearing a fellow preach on the mustard seed. And he said, the mustard grows up, and you can take part of it and the fibers and make the cloth out of it, and you take the seeds and do this, and you do something else. Well, that's not in there. That proverb teaches one major lesson. So look for that major lesson. And that's what we're looking for in this allegory of the two women. Now, Oholah was Samaria. And Oholah played the harlot when she was mine, and she doted on her lovers, on the Assyrians, her neighbors. Now, as I said a while ago, this 23rd chapter is dealing with the downfall of Israel and Judah on the ground of their relationship to foreign nations, their political alliances. Now, in order to understand this more clearly, class, an individual must realize that those nations, they identify their nation with their gods. Now, if a nation was victorious and triumphant and great, it was because of the greatness of their God. If another nation was weak, it was the weakness of their God. And so, for Israel to make an alliance with a heathen nation was to admit the weakness of Jehovah their God and the strength of this heathen God above their own God. Now, that's a form of idolatry, you see. So, for them to make these alliances which God forbade them making, don't make alliances with foreign countries, because there was a religious implication in those alliances there. There was a recognition of the strength of the God of those people. Now, to keep that in mind, we can better understand what Ezekiel is dealing with in this 23rd chapter. So he goes on to say now here, her lovers on the Assyrians, her neighbors. So that goes back to Tiglath-Pileser in his day when Nican, I believe was the king's name, first one to make an alliance with him. That was back before that fall, back about 750 or 40, along there, 45, and we're down to 590 or 92 now, a little later than that. All right. Who were clothed with blue. Now notice he's likening the Assyrian here unto these gallant soldiers, cavalrymen, who were clothed with blue, governors and rulers, all of them desirable young men, horsemen riding upon horses. And she bestowed her whoredoms upon them, the choicest men of Assyria, all of them, and on whomsoever she doted, with all their idols, she defied herself. So you see, Israel began to court the favor of Assyria, and to make an alliance with them, first with Tiglath-Pileser, later on with, Shalmaneser, and those individuals there, while they were actually submitting to the strength of their idols, don't you see? they were acknowledging the weakness of God so far as they were concerned there. So when we see that, we see what Ezekiel is really dealing with here. And he moves on, and neither hath she left her whoredoms since the days of Egypt. For in her youth they lay with her, and the hand of the bosom of her virginity, and they poured out their whoredom upon her. Now just what is involved in that period of their dwelling in Egypt, we know very little. So Ezekiel is dealing with something with which we are not familiar. So when we are not familiar with a thing and don't know what we're talking about, it's best not to offer any some hypothetical idea. So I really don't know what he's talking about here, but in some way her relationship with Egypt in the past had likewise been one of this political and religious whoredom or adultery there, harlotry. So here it goes way back. Wherefore I delivered her into the hand of her lovers, into the hand of the Assyrians upon whom she doted. And so because of Israel, the northern kingdom, the capital was Samaria, because she made these alliances with Assyria, because she admired the Assyrian power, admired the Assyrian army. You see, the whole Assyria here, like an unbeat gallant cavalrymen, dressed in their royal blue and flowing robes and all turbans flowing in the air and all of that, which she admired. So she admired the glory and the power and the grandeur of Assyria, made an alliance with them, which was in total violation of her relationship to God. All right? These uncovered her nakedness. They took her sons and her daughters, and they slew with her they slew with a sword, and she became a byword among women, for they executed judgments upon her. Right, so trying to make this alliance with Tiglath-Pileser, and later on Shalmaneser, but Sargon was the one that finally destroyed Israel and carried them away into captivity. So in doing that, in trying to court that favor, it resulted in her destruction at the hands of the Assyrians. Now just how familiar you are with this history depends on how much you've studied the book of Judges, Kings and Chronicles and those books back there, in which you find these things dealt with there in the historical context, where here he's putting all of these in the context of an allegory. And that makes you stand up and see how terrible it was there, as they committed a harlotry with her, took everything she had, then finally killed her sons and daughters and carried the remnant of them into Assyrian captivity. And they were lost to history, don't you see? Those 10 tribes. Now he moves now to her sister Oholiba. And her sister Oholiba, now that's Jerusalem, that's Judah, saw this. Yet was she more corrupt in her doing than she, and in her whoredoms, which were more than the whoredoms of her sister. Now that's saying then that by the time you come down to Ezekiel, that Judah has now become worse than Israel was. When you go back and study Israel's history, it's hard to see how we could get any worse than that. But when you come to Judah knew that, knew what Israel had done, knew what the consequence had been, and yet she outdid her sister in her whoredom, for she not only had to deal with the Assyrians, but later on the Babylonians. Now the Babylonians, she's now courting the favor of the Babylonians here in this. You remember that Hezekiah is probably my favorite of all of the old Hebrew kings. In some ways, because David is the one that stands out. But I think Hezekiah, in many ways, was a better man in some ways than David was. At least he didn't have so many other, but he had a fault. You remember when he got sick and he recovered, Merodach-Baladan, the king of Babylon, sent an embassage of congratulation to him, that's in the 39th chapter of Isaiah, to congratulate him on his recovery. That puffed him up. So he showed this embassage to Merodach-Baladan all of his treasure, everything that he had. God sent Isaiah right back to him and asked who were these men, and told him to what the season said everything I've got. Then Isaiah said, you'll be carried away into Babylonian captivity because of that. In other words, his pride led him to try to impress these Babylonians, these Chaldeans, how great he was. But his greatness wasn't of himself at all. He was from God. You see, so what he did there was a reflection on his relationship to God. And so Isaiah told him, said, you will not be carried away into Assyria. but you will be carried away into Babylon. That's in that 39th chapter of the book, if you want to read it sometime. All right? So now she doted upon, this is Judah now, she doted upon the Assyrians, governors and rulers, her neighbors, clothed most gorgeously, horsemen riding upon horses, all of them desirable young men. The same thing that she did that had impressed Ohola or Samaria, now then had impressed Judah also. So you have back seventh chapter. In the seventh chapter of Isaiah, you have Ahaz, King Ahaz of Judah, making an alliance with Assyria. So he made an alliance. I wish we had time to go back and get all this together, but we don't. But he made an alliance with Assyria. That's when God sent Isaiah to him and told him to ask a sign, either in the height above or in the depth beneath. He said, "No, I'll not tempt Jehovah my God." He had already determined what he was going to do. He had already made this alliance, made an agreement with the king of Assyria. So that's one instance back there in the earlier part. "And I saw that she was defiled. They both took one way." That is, both Israel and Judah took one way. They both tried to court the favor of Assyria, a great powerful nation. "And she increased her whoredoms, for she saw men portrayed upon the wall, the images of the Chaldeans portrayed with vermilion." That is, she saw those images, and that involved her with their worship. Now, the Chaldea, let's get Babylon and Chaldea straight. Chaldea was the province. That was the province. Babylon was the city, the capital of it. Now, there were times when they were separate, but most of the time Babylon is the capital of Chaldea. So when we talk about the Chaldeans, or we talk about the Babylonians, we're talking about the same people. Talking about the same people, the same race of people, the Chaldeans, either of Babylon as the rulers or Chaldea as the people of the nation. Now, if you have a question any time, I get a little too fast, raise your hand and ask it. Otherwise, I just keep rolling. I keep going here because I try to cover a certain amount anyway in this. And I notice here, "Girded with the girdles upon their loins and flowing turbans upon their heads, all of them princes, that is, noble individuals to look upon, after the likeness of the Babylonians in Chaldea, the land of their nativity." So Chaldea was the land of their nativity. Babylon was the city in which they dwelt. And there, as the army there, Nebuchadnezzar, and before him Nabopolassar, Nabopolassar was. Nabopolassar was the king that first tried to overthrow Assyria, revolted against Assyria. And Nebuchadnezzar, his son, was the one that led the army against Assyria and destroyed it. He was the one now that's ruler here in Babylon or Chaldea. "And as soon as she saw them, she doted upon them and sent messengers unto them into Chaldea." Right? Now, I think we could find some instances of that. Prince Hezekiah did when Merodach-Baladan came to him and congratulated him on his recovery. And he was a great king. But, and I've said this many times, every idol has its feet of clay. I don't care whether it's one you build or whether it's a man. Every individual that we exalt to a high pedestal out here of greatness, if you look carefully, you'll have feet of clay. There are some point at which, if you strike him, he'll go down. I think that's without exception. So that's what doesn't pay to try to be great, really. Because somewhere there's a toe down here, a foot of clay and iron which don't mix. And that's why you want to strike a fellow. And of course, I'm taking my figure from Daniel, the second chapter, you may recall back there. It's that great image, that is feet of clay. Well, now that's where the stone struck, feet of clay. That's where the opponent of an individual is going to strike at his feet of clay. Now, if you're always standing on truth and put God first and he's the servant of God, then he won't have feet of clay. Because he's standing on the Lord, standing in the Lord. And so, this is a point I think every preacher especially ought to learn. I don't care how great he is, when he gets too great, there's some feet of clay there somewhere, somebody's going to strike. Moving on. "And the Babylonians came to her into the land of love, and they defiled her with their whoredom, and she was polluted with them, and her soul was alienated from them." Now, they found to win the favor of Babylon. Now she came in, carried away some of the first ones captive, came back and carried some more captive, and then she became alienated from Babylon, her lover, And now she came back and destroyed them. So here is an allegorical picture of what took place between Judah and Babylon during this particular period, you see, some number of years before and now into the present day, if we're able to follow. So she uncovered her whoredoms and uncovered her nakedness. Then my soul was alienated from her, like as my soul was alienated from her sister. Right? Now God's soul is alienated now from Judah as it was from Samaria, because Samaria had tried to win the favor of by committing spiritual and political whoredom. That's what it is. Idolatry is spiritual whoredom. His political alliances were political whoredom. And they committed both of these, you see. So Judah did the same thing. Yet she multiplied her whoredom, remembering the days of her youth, wherein she had played the harlot in the land of Egypt. Now that's as he goes back, even before the dividing of the two of them, what took place there. Why, what are you going back to something in Egypt, and in the earliest, when they were down there, where he's talking about alliances such as Zedekiah tried to make an alliance there with Judah and sent, even before that. You go back to Isaiah. Isaiah pictures the king Ahaz, or whoever the king was at that time, sending spices and oil and all of that down into Egypt to make an alliance with. So the effort to court the fate of Egypt goes clear on back to see that early period of the divided kingdom. And both were courting their fate. Alright, so this is what he's talking about. And she doted upon a paramour whose flesh is as the flesh of asses, whose issue is like the issue of horses. Thus, that is greater flesh there. It's just simply as Egypt, or simply as beasts is all they were there, and that's what he's pointing out. You're trying to make an alliance with beasts here who worship is out of the animal that they worship, and you've seen the pictures of them. That's that what they worship, and they were like what they worship, and you become like that. So now then, it's pure flesh, and you're making your alliance with flesh instead of spirit. Well, Isaiah pictured the same thing there. That here, you're making flesh, the arm of flesh, your strength, rather than spirit. Well, that's what Paul's arguing with in Romans. That's what he's arguing with in Galatians. That is the difference between spirit and flesh. And when we rely on flesh, we're going down our weakness. We rely upon spirit, and we build strength, don't you see? So the Bible, all the way through the Old and New Covenant, is trying to impress God's people with the fact that you don't build strength on flesh, you build it on spirit. You have to learn the lesson. You have difficulty learning that lesson. I think most of us do. I think most of us have difficulty there. Why dost thou callest to remember the lewdness of thy youth in the handling of thy bosom by the Egyptians for the breasts of thy youth. So here then, that goes back to the fornication, adultery, our whoredom, or the harlotry, whatever you want to call it, that they committed back there in a political way. That involved a religious involvement as well as the other. All right, so this here is now come the punishment of the two. Now here's what they've done. You get the picture. It's an ugly picture. Ugly picture. Two sisters who married to Jehovah, God's people, who now are going to become actual prostitutes with these nations round about, these political nations. What can that God do about that? This is a good prelude to my lesson this morning in the 11th chapter of Romans. Unintentionally incidental, but it's a good prelude to it. For here you see these individuals in their unbelief, and that's what Paul's arguing in Romans there. The Jews were rejected of God because of unbelief all the way through, from the beginning down to the end. And they held on to their faith. I never cast off a person in his faith. Never did. Always in his unbelief. And he moves on now. Now the punishment for the harlot here. Therefore, O Oholiba, that's Judah. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will raise up thy lovers against thee, from whom thy soul is alienated, and I will bring them against thee on every side. Now, Judah was already becoming alienated from Babylon. Or you remember back in 605, this is written down after 592, somewhere after 592, when he began writing. So back there, Nebuchadnezzar came pursuing the Assyrians to Carchemish. Then from there he came on down pursuing the Egyptians, who had come up to try to help him, pursuing them back, and he came as far as Jerusalem and carried away Daniel with others into captivity. All right, then he came back 11 years later, 597, carried away 10,000 along with Ezekiel into captivity. Now this is a few years after that when he begins to write, somewhere between 592 and 72, that 20-year period there, he was writing. All right, and now you become alienated now. So you now hate these that you tried to court one time, don't you see? All right? I will bring them against you on every side, the Babylonians and all the Chaldeans, and here are three little nations, and he'll add Pit, Pekod, Shoah, and Koah, and all the Assyrians with them. That is, the Assyrians, which they have captured and brought into their army, will bring all of these now against Judah, don't you see? Well, that took place in 587, and the city fell in 586. And so this is between 592 and 586, is when he's speaking these things here, warning them what was going to come, the punishment. Dishonorable young men, governors and rulers, all of them, princes and men of renown, all of them riding upon horses. And they shall come against thee with weapons, chariots and wagons, and with a company of peoples. They shall set themselves against thee with buckler and shield and helmet round about. Those are all the instruments of war there. And I will commit the judgment unto them, and they shall judge thee according to their judgment. In other words, I'll let them judge what they're going to do to it. They'll be carrying out my will through the judgments that they execute. So their judgment will be that of destruction of this nation. And I will set my jealousy against them, and they shall deal with thee in fury. The terrible picture. They'll come upon thee with all that fury of those strong forces out to destroy them. Something like, I guess, the theory of the bombardment of over in Iraq here, the early part of the year. And they shall deal with thee in fury. They shall take away thy nose and thine ears, and thy residue shall fall to the sword. Now, whether that's figurative or not, I don't know. There was one king back there, when he captured it, something broke out in his harem there, he punished them by cutting off the ears and the nose of certain ones. So that could have been literal, could have been figurative. Over there in Tombstone, if you go in that place there, out there at Old Pit Corral there, there's a picture in there of an Indian who committed, an Indian woman committed adultery, and they cut a nose off of her. So that seems to go back quite a ways in history. An unfaithful woman that way, her nose is cut off, and her ears may be cut off. But anyway, whether this is literal, or whether it's figurative, there are literal instances of it. It's a terrible picture anyway, isn't it? What they're going to do to you. They shall take thy sons and thy daughters, and thy residue shall be devoured by the fire. Now they're going to take the better ones and carry them with the rest of them. They're going to kill them and they're going to burn the thing with fire. Now you remember Ezekiel's allegorical action back in chapter 4, wasn't it, or 4 or 5, when they cut off the shaved his beard and his head, put the hair divided into three groups, three little piles. One here, he cast under the fire. Another he hacked with a sword. Another he took and cast to the wind, hacking it with a sword and threw it out to the wind. Took a few hairs and bound them in his garments, you remember. These represent the remnant that God would save, whereas the rest of them would be destroyed. So now here you see him describing the fulfillment of that which he prophesied earlier in his prophesying. They shall also strip thee of thy clothes and take away thy fair jewels. Thus will I make thy lewdness to cease from thee, and thy whoredom brought from the land of Egypt, so that thou shalt not lift up thine eyes unto them, nor remember Egypt anymore. Don't look unto those heathen nations anymore, and go back and make alliances with them. Well, that's to reject me. And what did they do? So they committed two great sins. You remember Jeremiah said, my people have committed two sins. They have forgotten me, the fountain of living waters. And if you deny systems, broken systems, that can hold no water. Well, all right, that's to reject God and set up your own fountains there. Set up your own idols. That's what they have done. For thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I will deliver thee into the hand of them whom thou hatest, into the hand of them from whom thy soul is alienated. See, I tried to court them at one time with her favors, as that's a horrible word. Now then, hates them because of what they're doing to you, how they're behaving in this. Well, that sin does it. Sin has that characteristic. Whenever we court the pleasures of sin and engage in them, after a while, the wages of sin is death. We come out to hate what we did. Come to hate it, but too late. Can't undo it, you see. So now they begin to come to hate these whose favor they once courted. And that's true also of an individual that tries to seduce a girl and afterwards hates her, and she hates him after that. Oftentimes the case. We've read about that. You remember David's son. He committed adultery with his half-sister Tamar. Why, he hated her then. Had nothing to do with that then. And they shall deal with thee in hatred, and shall take away all thy labor, and shall leave thee naked and bare, and the nakedness of thy whoredom shall be uncovered, both thy lewdness and thy whoredom. So all of them are exposed. The ugliness and the nakedness of your sins all the way through. They're ultimately going to be exposed. That's going to be true in the life of an individual, true in the life of a nation. Ultimately, ours are going to be exposed. Well, let's move on now from get through. We're getting the picture, I hope. On here is a summary now of their sins, the punishment of the two women, which is the next few paragraphs, 30 to 39. These things shall be done unto thee, for that thou hast played the harlot after the nations, and because thou art polluted with thy idols. Now you see, that's where he joins the political with the religious, you see. So when you sought the favor of the nation, you were acknowledging the power of their gods, of their idols. So he combined the two in that verse that we said a while ago. Thou hast walked in the way of thy sister, therefore I give her the cup into thy hand. Thus saith that the cup of God's wrath. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, thou shalt drink of thy sister's cup, which is deep and large. Thou shalt be laughed to scorn and head in derision. It containeth much. Thou shalt be filled with drunkenness and sorrow, with a cup of astonishment and desolation, with the cup of thy sister Samaria. Thou shalt even drink it and drain it out. Thou shalt gnaw the shreds thereof, and shalt tear thy breast. For I have spoken, saith the Lord Jehovah. Therefore thus saith the Lord Jehovah, because thou hast forgotten me, cast me behind thy back. Therefore bear thou also thy lewdness, thy whoredom, and the consequence of it. Right? Now, what's the picture there? Here's the picture now after this Judah, youth there, courted these nations, all that. Now then, in her old age, she's like a harlot that nobody wants anymore. Ugly, just a hag, as it were. Now she turns to drink. So she drinks, and that drink, of course, in this allegorical picture, is the cup of God's wrath that Samaria had drunk of, which Samaria had drunk. They too had drunk the cup of the wrath of God. Now you're going to do the same thing. Well, it's like an old harlot that nobody wants anymore, and so now she turns to drink and to drunkenness. But that doesn't satisfy either. And so she winds up tearing herself and mutilating herself, as it were, in the agony of a soul that she realizes, and now she's suffering the consequence of it. I don't think you can paint an ugly picture of the consequence of sin. I don't know how I'd try to picture it. Someone that whom I read made the statement about Ezekiel. That Ezekiel was a great poet. He could describe a thing. And if he had just turned his attention to describing the beautiful instead of the sordid, he'd been praised today as one of the great poets of history. But God used him for a different purpose. God used him and used his talent to describe a thing here, to describe the ugly and the sordid and the lewd, that people might see the awfulness and ugliness of it. So we need to remember always, not everything is beautiful. Not everything is ugly. There is the ugly and there is the beautiful in this world, in this life. It's up to us to make the choice of what our life will be, the beautiful life, with a beautiful conclusion to it, or an ugly life with an ugly conclusion, such as Judas was back there. A great picture in it. Great lesson. We don't read the Old Testament much, and I doubt a very few of us ever read this chapter. I know, every time I teach Ezekiel, I think, well, I'm going to pass over this chapter. I'm just not going to read that one. It's ugly. But I don't do that. I always read it anyhow, because I want you to see the ugly as well as the beautiful. He could think, oh, now when we come later to the temple, describe the temple in all of its elegance and majesty and greatness, well, there he soars in every direction, you see. You see, the beautiful the beauty of God's spiritual temple in those last nine chapters of his book. Well, let me hasten along here. I want to finish this chapter, may not, but I'll get out far enough. You know. All right. Now, the 36. Jehovah said moreover unto me, Son of man, wilt thou judge Oholah, then declare unto them their abomination. This is kind of a summary of what he said. For they have committed adultery, and blood is in their hands. With their idols have they committed adultery, and they have also called their sons, whom they bear unto me, to pass through the fire unto them to be devoured. That is, offer them and burn their children, burnt offerings unto Moloch and other these heathen gods. We read about some of the, oh, Ahaz did that, and so did one of the others there. Especially, there were several of them that did that. Moreover, this they have done unto me. They have defiled my sanctuary in the same day and profaned my Sabbath. Now notice, for when they had slain their children to their idols, then they came to the same, in the same day unto my sanctuary to profane it, and lo, thus have they done in the midst of my house. Here they go out and offer the sacrifice of their kid there, of the child there, and then they to an idol. Then they come into the temple of God to offer praise unto him. Trying to tell both of them, you can't serve God in man. No man can. This was an abomination to God, and because of that idea that we put God on a common level with an idol that you offer your son in sacrifice to. And I really think that's one of the great problems today, that people are making God in their own image. They have determined what God is, and then they're worshiping him according to their own likes and dislikes. Paul argues that in Romans, the first chapter there. They're making God in their own image. That's what there's so many are doing today. Read what people think about religion today, about God today. What kind of picture is it? It's a picture from their own imagination and not from the Bible. They don't go there for the picture. All right, let me finish this chapter. I must do. And furthermore, you have sent for men that come from far, unto whom a messenger was sent, and lo, they came, for whom thou didst wash thyself, paint thine eyes, and deck thyself with ornaments, and sit upon a stately bed, or with a table prepared before it, whereupon thou didst set mine incense and mine oil. Now, here you deck yourself up like a harlot, there, with painted face and all that, or sitting on your bed of pillows, and sent for these to come in unto you here, and help you out and make alliances with. And I know what he goes on to say. And the voice of the multitude being at ease was with her, and with men of the common sort were brought drunkards from the wilderness, and they put bracelets upon the hands of them twain and beautiful crowns on their heads. Now here she's made alliances with just any kind of scum of the earth there, instead of turning to God. In a weakness, in a realization of her faith, she made this, sent these folks from drunk and low class individuals, made the alliances with them. That is what he's condemning. Now it's still an allegory. It's still pursuing the same allegory of these women in a more youthful time, bedecking themselves and sending out for lovers to come in. Wonder when Ezekiel said back in the 16th chapter there, that you're worse than an average harlot. The average harlot serves for hire, but you pay people to come in and hold them with you. That's the depth to which God's conceived his nation is having fallen. No wonder he destroyed it. No wonder. Well, it goes on that hurriedly. Then said I of her that was of old in adulteries, now will they play the harlot with her and she with them. And they went in unto her as they go in unto a harlot. So went they in unto Oholah and unto Oholibah, the lewd women. And righteous men, they shall judge them with the judgment of adulteresses and with the judgment of women that shed blood. Now, I don't know what he means there, that the righteous ones among them will recognize, even though this is going on, that it is wrong. Or will recognize that the righteous men of all ages will judge them as being worthy of death and destruction. Either may be true. I don't know which he's talking about. Because they are adulteresses and blood is in their hands. For thus saith the Lord Jehovah, I will bring up a company against them and will give them to be tossed to and fro and robbed. And the company shall stone them with stones. That, remember that. That was the penalty of adultery in the law there. And now whether that's literal or figurative, doesn't matter. And they shall recompense your lewdness upon you. Two young women, the same mother, after the division there, the same kingdom. Now these two are Jehovah's. And this is the point there. Now, not that he's endorsing polygamy or endorsing any of those things there. Just using an allegory there. They were his. Of course, you remember that Jacob had the two wives and two mistresses. Also, other old men that they dated and saw and all of them. So, he's not condemning or condoning. He's just going to use an illustration here. How low these two sunk in their political and religious alliances, and how they completely left God out, and what they did to win the favor of others, and then what happened to them. Go. God has got to cleanse it. over in the 35th chapter of the book of Numbers, God says that and concerning the murderer and not putting him to death or letting him go, if that pollutes the land, and the pollution can be cleansed only by the shedding of blood. Now sometimes it takes more than blood, it takes fire. So here the city of Jerusalem, God, the shedding of the blood of these people was in response to the murders that they committed, where the burning of the city was to cleanse it of all that idolatrous defilement. So when they came back from Babylon, they never again were idolaters. They weren't true to God, but they were certainly cured of idolatry. So it just takes a pretty strong lesson sometimes, doesn't it, to cure a person of whatever the problem may be. But I want to tell you one thing. God has a strong medicine to cure anything that comes along.